When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Listeners, be sure to check out slipdisc.com for the latest inside information on classical music now. Before we start today's episode, I want to share some super exciting news. We're hosting a live taping of Speaking Soundly, and you're invited. Mark your calendars now for Wednesday, April 24th at 7:30 p.m. in New York City at Lincoln Center's David Rubenstein Atrium. I'll be sitting down with the amazing Grammy Award-winning mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato. We'll discuss her early beginnings, her life as a singer, the creative process, and some of her more recent projects, including her return to the Met Opera stage this spring in the Hours. And best of all, it's free. That's right. No tickets are needed. Just show up. Again, don't miss our live taping of Speaking Soundly as part of Lincoln Center's Hear It Here podcast series on April 24th at 7:30 p.m. in New York City. For more information, check out lincolncenter.org/presents. And be sure to follow us on Instagram at SpeakingSNDLY. I'll see you there. America's preeminent banjo player, Bela Fleck, stands as a beacon of innovation in the world of banjo music. Renowned for his unparalleled skill and adventurous spirit, he's won 18 Grammy Awards, been nominated 38 times in 9 different fields, including everything from bluegrass to classical. Behind these groundbreaking achievements lies a tale of perseverance and defiance against the odds.
I was foolishly confident, especially, you know, now I can see how stacked the deck is against any banjo player who wants to make a living playing the banjo whatsoever. And if I had listened to the very, very good advice that I got, I would not be here talking to you right now.
You're listening to Speaking Soundly, a backstage pass to today's biggest stars of the music world. I'm your host, David Krause, principal trumpet of the Metropolitan Opera. During each episode, you'll hear me speak with inspiring performers about their creative process and the personal journey that led them to the stage.
Okay, I'm there, David. Hi.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Where are you?
Well, I'm in the kitchen of my apartment here in New York City. We're up close to Columbia University.
That's my old neighborhood.
Yeah, I know. And to be honest, I can't believe that you grew up just blocks from here because you play the banjo, so I just assumed that you grew up in like the Carolinas or the South somewhere. How does a kid who's born and raised on the Upper West Side of Manhattan get obsessed with bluegrass music so much so that you'd become the preeminent banjo player in all of the world? How does that even happen?
You tell me. I have no idea. It's the strangest thing. It's a mystery of my life, and there's no explanation that makes any sense except that there's a guy named Earl Scruggs who played the banjo and sort of invented this bluegrass style. And he has a way of converting people. Like if you're going to be a banjo player and you hear Earl Scruggs, it like flips a circuit in your brain. And all of a sudden you become a zombie banjo seeking bloodsucker looking, you know, who can't live without an instrument, without a banjo. And that it happened to me. It's happened to almost every one of the top banjo players that I know in the bluegrass scene. They heard Earl Scruggs and it just shook them up. It changed everything. And so I have that memory of being a little kid at my grandparents' house in Queens in Flushing and hearing the Beverly Hillbillies, which of course is a silly show, but the banjo playing was just fabulous and has turned a lot of people on to banjo. But growing up in New York City, I grew up on 100th Street in West End. There was a folk boom that happened in the 60s, and there was remnants of that around New York City for me to glom onto and find people who played banjo. And I wasn't that attracted to bluegrass. I just liked the banjo. So it was just the sound of the banjo. But as years have gone on, I found my home in the bluegrass world and have expanded outward from there, you know, based on all the stuff I heard when I was a kid in New York.
While I have you here, I feel like I want to admit another misconception I had about you just after seeing your albums on my dad's shelf. My dad had a bunch of your records, and that's how I got exposed to your music. I always assumed that you were Hungarian because your name is Béla, like Béla Bartók, the famous Hungarian composer. I always made that connection, but it turns out that you were actually named after Béla Bartók. Not only him, you're actually named after two other modernist composers. When you were growing up, were you aware of this musical kinship that you would have to these somewhat eclectic classical composers?
Yeah, well, the story is that my mother and my father, they made a deal that if I was a boy, I'd be named by my father. If I was a girl, I'd be named by my mother. And my father was very much into the composers that I'm named after. So that would be Anton Webern and Leos Janacek and Bartók. And he was a classical guy who he wanted to be an opera singer but couldn't make the grade. But the ironic part is that he got to name me, and he got to name my brother, who of course is Ludwig, and you know, so he goes by Louis, because that's a pretty tough name to grow up in the mean streets of New York with. Ludwig. So, you know, he doesn't use that, but that's technically it. But then they split up, like when I'm 1, 2 years old, something like that. And he is not a father who's around. In fact, he's a father I don't meet again until I'm in my 40s. So I have these names and this lineage of sort of these modern composers, and yet no connection to the person who gave me these names. Then along comes my stepfather, Joe Palladino, who ironically was also a cellist, who was in the 7th Army Symphony and always made cello playing and chamber music a big part of his life. So when he got together with my mom, there would be chamber music in our house on Sundays. He would have 4 or 5 people over and they'd read down whatever it was, you know. But his tastes were not in the modern. I don't remember them playing any Bartók, Webern, or Janacek. It was all, you know, nice Mozart, you know, nice stuff. Right. He wasn't going for the mange, the edges. I always liked it, you know, when they played, I couldn't really read, and I still really can't read typical notation, but I could look at the paper and watch the notes go up and down and follow them when they were, you know, on the couch while they were playing string quartet music, and often I'd fall asleep. It didn't have the rhythmic intensity that was, I later found out, was my motor, but I was exposed to it.
So you fall in love with the banjo at 5 or 6, but you don't play one until you're in high school. Like, you didn't get an instrument until then. Why the delay?
I didn't think I could ever play it. So I never told anybody, and I never tried to get one because it sounded impossible. It didn't sound like something a mortal could do. So in the time between my awakening to the glories of the banjo, I asked my mother for guitar lessons. I learned how to play Kumbaya. I got a Beatles book. And then there was a guy upstairs in our building on 820 West End Avenue. There was a guy up on the 6th floor named Eddie, and he was an electric guitar player who gave lessons. And so I went up to take lessons from him, and he started to show me the blues scale. And I wasn't very interested, but it registered. So then by 7 years later or so, when I'm almost 15, Dueling Banjos comes out, and banjos are suddenly a big deal. And my grandfather, who lived in Peekskill, I went to visit him the day before I started high school. So I was 15, and he said, "Hey, I heard, you know, you play guitar. I saw this at the flea market. It was $40. Do you want it? Cheap banjo." And I flipped. I was like, I never would have bought one for myself. And he put it in my hands. When we took the train home, the Hudson line down from Peekskill back to the city for school the next day, a guy was on the train. I mean, he would have looked like a Brooklyn beatnik kind of guy, hippie kind of guy, and he came over and said, "Hey, is that a five string?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Do you know how to play it?" I said, "No." And he said, "Want me to tune it up for you?" I said, "Yeah." And so on the way back on the train, literally the day I got the instrument, there's a guy tuning it up for me and showing me the basic way it works. And then when I got back to the city, I got the Pete Seeger book and I started taking lessons, and I just started rocketing through, you know, banjo. And I switched from a deep type B character who was interested in the guitar and played around with it a little bit to a type A character that couldn't put the instrument down at all. But I have to say those blues guitar scales that Eddie was teaching me, when I went to the banjo, I tried to do those too, which actually people weren't doing on the banjo. So it started to open up my mind to a different way to look at the fingerboard right from the beginning.
When you finally got home after that train ride and it's tuned up, did those first notes feel like it was a completely natural fit, or was it disconcertingly hard?
Yeah, it was just so attractive that I just kept banging myself up against it, trying to get it to sound like what I thought it was supposed to sound like, but I couldn't. And that's one of the weird things about the banjo, with the repeated notes and strings that sound like each other. Even when I got banjo music that I could sort of pick out very slowly, like from the Pete Seeger book, nothing didn't sound anything like what I was hearing when I listened to banjo playing. So I was very confused by it. And so finally I got some lessons from a guy named Eric Darling, who was giving lessons. I think it was on 66th Street. And I was just racing through it. And pretty soon he sent me to another guy out in Staten Island named Mark Horowitz. And pretty soon after that, he sent me to another guy. I mean, I just rocketed through these teachers. And soon I was luckily with a guy who was like the modernist of the banjo, who happened to be from Syracuse, a guy named Tony Trischka. And Tony became my hero and teacher. I tried to be his protege for a long time.
This quick progression on the instrument sounds prodigious to me, because you start working as a professional musician at 19, right after high school.
It was very fast. By the time I was done with high school, people would say, you know, there'd be parties and I'd be jamming with Tony Trischka, and people would say, I couldn't tell who was who, you know, because I was just so into him and the way he played. And I was a carbon copy of him. But at a certain point I had a realization that there already was a Tony Trischka and I wasn't him. And I had better start finding my own unique ways around the instrument if I wanted to continue to do it. The other interesting thing that happened is, remember that my mother and my stepfather are teachers in the school system. When I was a senior in high school, I had my little brother, a bit unexpected. And because they were so focused on this new baby, I managed to make it through high school without applying to any colleges. Now imagine that, you know, with teacher parents, that I managed to get away with that. And it wasn't until it was too late and they realized, and they were very upset that I hadn't done anything about college. And so suddenly I was free. I got out of high school. I was like a free man. And Tony had an offer to join a band in Boston, and he wasn't going to do it. So I went up there and auditioned and took that job. And boom, I was in a professional band right out of high school.
So obviously that's the dream for an aspiring musician, to bypass college and just go straight to performing and doing exactly what you want to do. But was there any fear or reluctance at all that maybe you wouldn't make it?
I don't remember any fear. I was foolishly confident, especially, you know, now I can see how stacked the deck is against any banjo player who wants to make a living playing the banjo whatsoever. And if I had listened to the very, very good advice that I got, I would not be here talking to you right now. I wasn't going to be turned, because my mother would say, come on, just something to fall back on. You know, we'll help you go to school. And as time went on, those kind of murmurings stopped. And it became clear that I was going to be okay. And I was playing with good bands and we were making decent money. And they didn't have to worry about that.
After you were in Boston as a working musician, you decided to move to Kentucky to immerse yourself in bluegrass music and the tradition there. I'm curious if you felt more like an outsider as a New Yorker in Kentucky or as a banjo player in New York, because both are uncommon, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Boston was actually very natural. I didn't feel the same kind of anti-banjo kind of vibe that I sometimes felt in New York City as a kid walking around with the banjo. So the band broke up that I was in at a certain point, and I played on the street in Harvard Square for a season, which I loved. It was playing for people walking by for spare change. It was great. It was really fun. And then I moved south because I felt like I wasn't really good at bluegrass. I did, and I wanted to be good at everything. I was egotistical enough to think I could be good at everything. So I moved to Kentucky, where one of the great traditional players, a guy named J.D. Crowe, kind of held court, and he had bands. And I just watched him play every night, and I started to develop a real love for the way the Southern guys felt things rhythmically and the tone they were getting out of their banjos, which was a whole different thing. There's a lot more focus on that. Where up north, the ultimate was what kind of new things could you do that hadn't been done? And down south, they weren't thinking that way. They were thinking, how can I make this thing pocket? How can I make this banjo sing? How can I get the best tone out of this thing? And I thought it was a good marriage. Like, I could never become the traditional player those guys were and never will, but I could incorporate a lot of things about their sense of time, the kind of instruments they were playing, and the kind of feel and tone that they were getting, and bring that to a more modern approach of banjo playing. So I kind of incorporating all these things, and it was a good period for that. Then I got a call from Sam Bush, who was an iconoclastic kind of modern hippie musician that was making a new bluegrass called Newgrass. Newgrass Revival was the band. And it was the preeminent band in that world. And I got a chance to join that band and be in it for eight and a half years and kind of ride the peak of the scene. So that was fabulous.
Your curiosity for music really propels you to master whatever genre you're taking on and be at home within it. Is there any music out there that's proved to be too difficult for you?
I would say I'm a professional banjo player in that I can make it sound professional in various idioms. It doesn't mean I'm a master of that idiom. It means I got good enough to do what I had in front of me. And I would say my experience with Chick Corea was very much of like, hey, Chick, you know I'm not really a jazz musician, right? And he's like, you don't worry about it. You be yourself and I'll make it work out. And he was enough of a jazz musician to listen to me and know how to make it sound like legit. But I couldn't have followed him into half the things he did. You know, right. I couldn't have cut it. I wouldn't have had the wherewithal to pull it off. But we could find a meeting ground. But I wasn't supposed to be him. I was supposed to be me. So that's what finally I became more comfortable with, that I'm not going to be this. I'm not going to be Josh Bell. I'm not going to be Edgar in classical music. I'm not going to be Chick Corea in jazz. But because I have this instrument and these abilities and this interest in this other music, that makes me an interesting puzzle piece to interact with for these guys. And I have to bring something to it.
So you wrote, performed, and recorded your own banjo concerto, which you specifically named the Impostor Concerto. In fact, one of the movements, the text to one of the movements says that you're a low-class banjo-playing scuffler, yeah, and you should be tossed out. This sounds more like a therapy session than a concerto. Can you talk to me about the process of writing and performing it?
Okay, yeah. I mean, it is funny because when you spend most of your time playing with musicians that are from fields that you're not part of, you can have some imposter syndrome going on. And I spend so much time playing and trying to fit into jazz, being accepted in the jazz world. I spent time trying to be in the classical world, and if we're in a rock band, someone says, hey, get on up here and play, and I'll jump up. I'm all kinds of settings, you know, Latin musicians, and I have to figure out how to make the banjo work in that setting. There's a lot of uncertainty, you know, but I have to be bold and act like I know what I'm doing and figure out a solution that seems to work in all these different settings. So it dawned on me at one point that the only place I can think of where I know exactly what to do is bluegrass. That's the place where I know what every banjo player from Earl Scruggs on up has done. So I'm totally at home and I don't feel like an imposter. But everywhere else, there's a slight feeling of like, you guys know I'm not from Africa. I'm in Africa playing with these guys. You know I'm not actually from Mali. Yeah, we know. Well, that was the joke. But at any rate, when I did the imposter, I actually had already written one concerto, maybe even two with Edgar. But there still was no banjo concerto for just, and especially one written by the person who played it, who was going to play it, which I thought was an important thing to do. And luckily, Nashville Symphony thought it was too, and they they gave the go ahead and I went ahead and did it. And I think as I was writing it, I was feeling like an imposter. I was trying to write the piece, but as I went along, I got more confident. And so I think the writing kind of shows that. It takes a while for the flow to start to happen in terms of composing. It also reminds me of a Gahan Wilson cartoon where the conductor is in hell and he walks into the room and there's all these banjo players in there. And that's what hell is for him. So it was just all in my head. But I kind of felt like there was a storyline there where I'm trying to pretend that I'm a classical musician, but I'm not. And as the piece goes on, I start to become more comfortable being myself. And in the end, I let bluegrass out of the bag and they're all after me trying to kick me out of the orchestra. Like there's a costume party that I'm snuck into and nobody knows that I'm there because I'm wearing a costume. And then, but near the end, they figure out that I'm not supposed to be there. And then there's a big chase.
But that seems to be a through line with your career, kind of like a screw it, I'm doing this attitude. And it works out where so many people would never have dreamed to do it or had the fortitude to master it.
Well, thank you. I think it's really comes a lot from my grandfather, Morris Rosen. I'm not exactly sure where he came from, but Jewish, and my grandmother, her family from Ukraine. They got to New York before the Second World War, but there was that very much of that like DIY, figure stuff out for yourself, you know,
tenacity,
but also like creative solutions to things rather than like learning how to do something from someone who knows, just figure it out. And I almost feel like when I look at Gershwin and I'm thinking about him, I see that in him. Like, no, I'm not a classical composer, but hey, here's my piano concerto. I'm going to do it and I'm not going to pussyfoot around. I'm not going to hem and haw. This is it. I'm doing it. So I think there's something of that in me too, of just sort of figure it out for yourself, do it for yourself. My grandfather could solve any problem, but he wouldn't do it in a conventional way. And here's an example. He had a house in Peekskill and I remember being there. And he would always be working on it. He'd always be in the crawl space or always messing with the plumbing or whatever. And I came back there after he had passed just to see the house. And there was a guy there who was trying to sell it. And he let me look around and I said, well, what's the story here? He said, well, we can't sell this house because the plumbing is not up to codes. It works perfectly, but no plumber has been able to figure out why or how. He probably figured it out some kind of crazy way that made sense to him. And it worked. But it was not conventional and he didn't have any training as a plumber.
Your career has been a tapestry of amazing collaborations with great artists, whether it's your own band, the Flecktones, playing with an Indian tabla virtuoso like Zakir Hussain, or with the legendary pianist Chick Corea. You seem to have this innate ability to play well with others. Was this learned, or do you think it's just a part of your personality?
I don't know. I'm not eager for the spotlight, to tell you the truth. And I think in bluegrass, let's talk about Sam Bush for a second, who's one of the greatest ensemble players in any musical form that's ever lived. He's a mandolin player, but the way he plays rhythm is something that makes other people play better. Tony Rice, the guitarist, and Sam Bush together were like the rhythm team from God, because everybody who played with them played better than they ever played in their life. And so being around those guys made you want to be able to do that. So I think I took that into the Flecktones. And when I found Victor and Future Man and Howard, our ethos was to try to make something together that felt right. It was really very much about support and groove. And so Victor once said, I mean, the biggest compliment I ever got from maybe from anybody was, he said, when you play banjo and different kinds of music, it just sounds right. Like it was supposed to be there in the first place. I can't tell you why that is. But when he said that to me, I realized that that is what I'm going for. It's not so much that it's complicated or show-offy. It's just that it fits and it's supposed to be there. And that's my goal in anything that I do. If it starts to feel like it's jammed in there and it doesn't fit, I don't feel very comfortable about it.
Well, I think that influence of those players really rubbed off on you, because even to watch you perform, you have this particular stance and this look on your face. I don't know how to describe it other than it's the absence of what every guitarist looks like when they're playing a solo. Like there's no hubris, there's no grandstanding, you're not wearing the music on your face, you're just focused. When you perform, what specifically are you focused on?
Well, you can't micromanage it. Like, it doesn't work, as you know, as a musician. If you micromanage, oh, when that F sharp comes, I got to just really, you know, you got to really be calm. And when you stay calm and you're calm enough and the music can start to flow through you. I think one clue is that when I have played well, I don't know what happened. And I can, you know, I can verify it by listening to tapes, live tapes. But on a show where I don't, like the show started and at the end of it, I can't really remember what happened. It was probably a really good night. On a night when I can tell you everything that went wrong, it was a struggle and I wasn't having a good time. But so you're trying to get in a zone, and you're, especially when you're improvising at top speeds with people, your unconscious has to kick in and handle things. You train yourself to a point where your unconscious can take over and handle it. And then instead of going, oh my God, I got to change the scale here and I got to do this. And oh, he just played that, so I better do this. I don't have time to say any of that. And it's really fun. It's exhilarating.
Well, it sounds really exciting. It's amazing that you've been making music for 4 decades now. Are you ever surprised that music continues to play such an important role in your life?
Well, I know it's what I'm supposed to be doing for whatever reason. And when I'm not doing it, I start to get uncomfortable. And if I don't have something I'm working on that I'm really excited about, life starts to become black and white. I've just been this way for a long time. And I think I'm healthier when I'm playing music. I'm happy. I'm comfortable. When I'm not, I'm not so happy.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Speaking Soundly. If you like what you heard, please tell your friends about it. Spread the word. Be sure to follow, rate us, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. To keep up on future episodes, follow us on Instagram at Speak.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
SNDLY and visit our website, artfulnarrativesmedia.com. Tune in next week as we hear another inspiring artist speaking soundly.